This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Broadband Wireless Access World. We're about to speak to Stephen Glappa at ArrayCom, a maker of advanced antenna systems. Welcome to Utopia Media's Broadband Wireless Access World.
Thank you, Mark.
Maybe we could just review a little bit from our last conversation the distinctions among MIMO, advanced antenna systems, and smart antennas before we move on to some of the new issues today.
Sure. There's, as I think we talked about last time, there's a reasonable amount of confusion in the industry about the names we use for all this stuff.
Right, and we're hoping to clear that up at least a little.
Yeah,
and you can, of course, go into the sort of the politics of it and how different people would like these things to be called different things.
Yeah, I guess it's probably not worth spending a lot of energy on that.
Right.
Because it really kind of shakes out in terms of people trying to bring forward their own subset of the landscape as,
right,
as the answer to things.
It's kind of a question of framing, even.
Yeah. Yeah. So the industry term smart antennas was originally put forward as a way to refer to systems that use multiple antennas either on the downlink or on the base station or on the subscriber device ends of the link or both. And so a number of different architectures have been developed around these basic concepts, and we still use the term smart antennas to refer to the whole taxonomy of all those architectures.
Right.
And there are a couple of different key dimensions that vary as you look at different branches in that taxonomy. One is how many antennas do you have on which end of the link? So
okay,
there's multiple on either subscriber device or client device or client device or base station or both.
Right.
And then the other is what kind of processing are you doing?
Right.
And there are varying degrees of sophistication of different processing techniques. Some are, you know, simple. They're sort of, if you will, advanced forms of diversity.
Right.
Maximum ratio combining is a good example of that. And then there are others that are more complex in the sense that what they're trying to do is, instead of just trying to average out interference using a couple more sources of information, which some of the simpler forms do, you're actually trying to take a system-level view and manage the creation of interference in the first place, so to mitigate the interference between co-channel users, whether it's between client devices or between client devices and neighboring base stations and so forth.
And again, to go back, the kind of interferences that are being dealt with are multipath and co-channel.
Multipath isn't so much we think of interference as being separate and distinct from multipath.
Oh, okay.
So multipath and scattering happen whenever you try to send a signal from one place to another,
right,
in the radio environment.
Right.
Interference that we try to manage more actively,
okay,
is what's created when you are trying to send a signal using the same radio resource.
Okay.
You're trying to reuse a radio resource more than once within a given geography.
The same frequency.
Yeah, so the same frequency, and of course you have to be careful. It's not just the frequency. It's also, in the case of a TDMA scheme, it's the time slot. In the case of a CDMA scheme, it's the code.
Right.
In an OFDM, it's tone and time slot.
Okay. And those are all dimensions that smart antennas can manage, systems,
correct,
advanced.
So if you look at a lot of the terms that are being bandied about, back to the original question,
right,
MIMO is itself an umbrella term that incorporates lots of different processing techniques that are applied to systems that have, hence the term, multiple inputs to the airlink and multiple outputs from it. So
right,
there are multiple transmit antennas, multiple receive antennas involved on both ends of the link.
Okay, so there's essentially a continuum from the simpler to the more complex,
mm-hmm,
and presumably the more complex require greater resources but are more powerful and can create more potent bandwidth and access functionality.
Right, and the thing we hasten to point out is that when you say more resources, yes, there is marginally more processing power required to do some of the more sophisticated things,
right,
but the key thing that drives the cost in an implementation of smart antennas is the multiplication of radio chains and all the hardware. So the thing that's interesting is once you've put the multiple radio chains in place in the hardware on either or both ends of the link, then the marginal cost of adding a little bit more sophisticated processing is greatly outweighed by the marginal benefit you get by the more sophisticated techniques.
Okay.
So hence you see techniques like what was put forward by MetaWave, a so-called applique solution, where instead of designing the smart antennas in up front, in the architecture of the system, you kind of paste it on the outside with another box on the base station side. That doesn't work well because you end up replicating a lot of the hardware cost. You don't get to use a sophisticated technique. You replicate a lot of the hardware cost of the base station itself. You don't get to use the sophisticated techniques, so the cost-benefit ratio just doesn't quite work.
So the best practices right now are what exactly in terms of what to install in terms of hardware and the migration paths that may become available with better systems?
Right. So the first point is you design it in from the outset.
Right.
So at design time for your client device or your base station. The second thing is there are a range of antenna count choices you can make from, two through very large numbers.
Right.
For the most part, people are settling on two antennas on the client device.
Right.
And typically four, although there are some discussions of eight antennas per sector in the next generation systems on the base station side.
Okay. Which leads more or less directly to the question of standards and the standard setting process. Mm-hmm. Why don't we start with the technical issues that need to be resolved through the standard setting process before we talk about the structure of that process itself?
Right. So there isn't exactly an answer for the specifics of how a standard needs to incorporate, needs to accommodate smart antennas, but there are some general principles. So the implementation of the general principles depends on which standard we're talking about exactly. But,
right.
But generally speaking, the tool you're using to improve system performance is this management of co-channel interference.
Okay.
That's really the core of the discussion.
Right.
And there are other tools in terms of diversity that help you provide more robust links and so forth, but they're kind of secondary.
Okay, again, focus just a second. Tell everyone what co-channel interference is and why it's a problem, and why solving it is the key to the standard setting process.
Right. So, in a two-way radio system, this notion of a radio resource that I talked about earlier is a quantity in finite supply in a given geography.
Whether it's CDMA or something else, whatever it is, there's a limited amount of it.
It's guaranteed. The laws of physics dictate that there is a limited amount, and therefore, as you look at trying to maximize an operator's financial return from building a network, they want to fit as many subscribers on a given dollar of spectrum investment or equipment investment as they possibly can.
Right.
And as cellular usage continues to rise, and in particular, as operators are moving toward mobile broadband kinds of service concepts with IPTV and mobile TV and true broadband access on mobile devices, the whole deal.
Right.
The pressure on the operating metrics for these networks just continues to go up.
And when talking about mobile broadband as a general category, this refers to both cellular and IP type systems?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Meaning whether you get it through Wi-Fi, WiMAX, or EVDO,
any of the above,
okay.
Or HSDPA, or even a good old WCDMA.
Okay.
So this resource of spectrum plus time slot or spectrum plus code is in limited supply, and the pressure, the demand on that supply continues to go up. So what you want to do is reuse those resources as many times as you can within a given space.
Right.
And that's where managing co-channel interference is important because the way it works today is, take a WCDMA system. If I'm using in my single 5 megahertz carrier one of the codes in a given cell, I can't use that code for another conversation or another data stream until I'm 2 or 3 or 7 sectors away. It depends on the thing. So if you can create a system that reduces the amount of that code's signal that is essentially spam, going places where you don't need it, rather than going directly to the user and back to the base station, then you can tighten up your reuse pattern.
Right, exactly. So to give this some sort of visible image in space, we've got a tower, an installation somewhere that's transceiving these signals, and you've got mobile users and stationary users all moving around through space around that. And essentially what you're saying, rather than spamming or broadcasting to widely to everyone in the vicinity, the purpose of these smart antenna systems is to be able to essentially focus the communication between the base station and the user device so that it can be used for someone next door in the same way. That's the point of all this.
That's one of several points. It's important to understand that, and I sort of got these backwards in terms of how operators think about them in time. In an initial network deployment, the issue is actually range and subscriber data rate.
Okay.
And all these things are sort of complicated and involved with each other. So subscriber data rate influences is a function of your range choice and also influences capacity in the network overall.
Right. But essentially the goal of what's going to try to be achieved here is to provide the most bandwidth at the greatest range to the most users.
With the highest data rate.
Right. Okay.
So that concentration of energy that you've captured the idea quite well also gives you better range. Because instead of having multipath and scattering diffuse your signals into ineffectivity, if you will, you can concentrate them on that subscriber and get simply higher dB in your link budget in the jargon.
And that would, in fact, mean you'd have to hand off from base station to base station less often.
Correct.
Okay.
So in the initial... So you can think of kind of two phases of a network's operation from an operator's perspective. There's the initial range-limited deployment, where the multiple antennas on one or both ends of the link simply get you longer range for a given cell footprint. And then in the capacity-limited domain, you get more subscribers per base station than you would otherwise.
Right.
And the prospect for these mobile broadband kinds of networks is to move from range to capacity-limited more universally across the network and more quickly than was the case for cellular, which is what's prompting so much interest in smart antennas these days. And then now we're back to the standards question.
Exactly.
So in order to achieve these results, the range result is a little easier to achieve without the standard really accommodating multiple antennas in any form. The capacity result is a little more complicated because in order for us to tune this distribution of radio energy, we have to do something that's called channel estimation in the jargon.
Okay.
Or, you know, you can think about it like building a little model in the base station or in the client device of the radio environment and then acting accordingly.
Right.
In order to build that model, you have to have some pieces of information.
Right.
Some calibration or some sampling of what the radio environment is about. And in many cases, you can get that simply by looking at the normal traffic that you've just had between client device and base station. But if there's the possibility of adding a little preamble of training data, if you will, in the overhead associated with the communication at the airlink level, you can improve the model substantially.
What kind of training data are you talking about?
Well, this gets into fast Fourier transforms and so forth.
Give us a short definition of a fast Fourier transform.
perhaps not in this discussion.
Okay.
The processing of at the base station side or the client device side, either way, the processing of this sea of RF information you're getting on your antenna is a fairly complex thing.
Right.
And so there are some tricks that you can do to more easily resolve one user from another quickly and get information from frame to frame about what that user's radio channel looks like that you can then use on the next frame.
When you use the word frame, it calls to mind video processing. Is there almost an analogy there between video standards that only show the changes in the next frame work similarly to show only the changes in the RF environment?
Well, there's a sort of a remote analogy in the sense that the antenna processing does work frame to frame, so it's a little bit like an MPEG encoder.
Right. And it would say that
it's not particularly relevant because the data itself is not
comparable.
The encoding part.
Yeah. Okay.
But in any event, so some of those tricks that you can do in the data channel itself to help both ends of the link understand the path between each other better is part of what needs to get put in the standard. The other piece is the rational organization, we like to say, of users in time and frequency.
Right.
So this whole point is a lot of what we're talking about here is managing the distribution of radio energy in space as the new dimension that we're addressing.
Right.
The more cleanly users are organized in time and frequency, the more possible it is to do that.
And you want to have them all labeled the same, their usage labeled the same way for everybody.
And yeah, you could think of what I, the previous point about some training data as almost a label.
Okay.
But so it, there are some techniques associated with interference mitigation that are really about interference averaging. So CDMA is a good case in point. Everybody's using the same frequency within a given carrier, but they're using these different codes to resolve them.
Right.
And by spreading their communication across the band, rather than giving them a very narrow channel, in effect, you're averaging out some of the effects of multipath and scattering.
Right.
And that helps, again, if you only have one antenna to work with. As soon as you start introducing multiple antennas, then the entire thought process about the protocol itself is upended to a certain extent. And that set of tools you use to mitigate interference issues and scattering and multipath and so forth with a single antenna solution starts to work against you when you have multiple antennas.
And so you need a new approach.
So you need a new approach. And this is why if you look at the long-term evolution for 3G and the 3GPP2 process, they're looking at OFDM and smart antennas together. Now, OFDM goes back, it kind of moves away from the wide carrier back to very narrow carriers, these orthogonal tones, which are the basis of OFDM.
Right.
And it is possible to organize users more cleanly so that there are fewer co-channel users per radio resource.
Okay.
Inherently in the time and time and frequency domain. And then the space domain becomes more easy for, more easily managed.
All right. And so is the issue that there are multiple conceptual approaches on how to do this? Or is there only one and everyone's trying to work on how to perfect
well,
it?
Well, interestingly, what's happening in, if you look at what's happening with Qualcomm and 802.20,
right.
what's happening with 3GPP2 and LTE, and what's happening in the 802.16e process where the WiMAX forum is defining these profiles and certification testing standards
right.
that narrow down the number. 802.16e is a collection of interesting options in order to get interoperable equipment with any sort of rational plan. The WiMAX forum is defining these profiles that will dictate what the standard becomes in a de facto sense.
Right. So,
and in all three of those cases, the world is settling on OFDM plus smart antennas as the right way to go about achieving the kind of operator objectives that these mobile broadband networks are being set out to attain.
Okay. Well, then, where is the are there different standard setting processes for these different technologies?
Well, there. 802.20, 802.16e, plus the WiMAX forum, and 3GPP2 managing the long-term evolution of the 3G WCDMA standards, they're all three separate and distinct. But right. interestingly, they've all settled on the same dominant design,
okay.
one might call it, which
right.
is a combination of OFDM and smart antennas.
Okay, so that's going to be good for your company and probably good for the standard-setting process as well.
Well, it's good for the operators, it's good for the subscribers, and, of course, you know, it doesn't hurt us either.
Right. Now, what procedures remain to be gone through in order to end up with standards that can then start being applied and implemented?
Well, it depends. It's different in each case.
Okay.
802.16e is actually the furthest along.
Right.
And right now, the procedures are all about commercial organizations implementing against the standard.
Right.
The standard is the 802.16e standard itself was approved. The profiles are. There's some discussion about certification processes. And
right. So essentially,
what exactly is done where, but that's right. essentially done.
So essentially, there's a standard that's agreed upon, and what's happening now is implementing against the standard. That's also what you were talking about. These profiles, right?
Right. Yeah. So 16 is in full implementation mode.
Okay.
802.20. The recent events are that a proposal, largely from Qualcomm, although Kyocera was involved in it as well. Was approved in 802.20, and so somewhere in the next probably single-digit number of months, that standard will be wrapped up.
Okay, and the third?
And for 3GPP2 and LTE, that's a longer story, and no one's expecting hardware to be implemented for LTE until probably 2009.
So does this mean that there's going to be a competitive advantage for people who want to get broadband wireless mobily or statically using 16E and 20 rather than 3G?
Maybe.
Okay.
So when you go from the sort of abstract world of standards,
right,
and the marketing world of manufacturers who are implementing the standards with grand aspirations, then
right,
you hit this practical reality of operators and their starting point. And there are sort of some key dimensions of what their starting point involves, which is what kind of network they have deployed today.
What kind of operators are we talking about here?
Wireless operators.
Okay.
Or wireline operators who want to go back into or get into wireless in the first place.
Okay.
So it's the guys who build the networks and run them and sell services on top of them, which may or may not be the same thing.
Okay.
But that's what we call operators.
Okay.
Service providers, in
all right,
words.
And what are the dimensions of their preparedness at this point?
So their starting point or their initial conditions are pretty important to understand. So
right,
what kind of network they already have.
Right.
You know, if it's a 2G network or a 3G network, or if they've already rolled out HSTPA,
right,
what their deployment is and so forth, how many subscribers they have, what kind of financing they have, and what spectrum they own.
Right.
So all of these things influence what is the right, quote, right technology choice.
Because essentially these operators are going to be able to upgrade their existing networks through this advanced
right,
antenna
so,
technology.
So for instance, just to take a couple extreme points.
Right.
If I'm T-Mobile in Germany and I've just deployed 9,000 sites of WCDMA in Germany,
right,
which
right,
they have,
right,
and they're looking at moving to these kinds of mobile multimedia services, HSDPA is a fantastic solution for them because it's not exactly a software upgrade only to their base stations, but it's pretty close.
Right.
And they can put smart antennas on the client device side,
right,
without influencing the standard in any form, without waiting for standard changes. And, you know, boom, they get, you know, a nice new network to do things on.
Right.
That would be competitive, you know, along the dimension of what kind of services they can offer, to a brand new network built on WiMAX.
Got it.
Because the brand new network would have all the disadvantages of having to start from scratch,
right,
more or less, with site acquisition and all these other things.
Right.
However, if you're you know, a small new entrant in Germany,
right,
who got his hands on some 2-point-something spectrum,
right,
in Germany, which is, you know, a possibility, then a WiMAX network would be the right place to start because it's going to give you the maximum performance you can get in the current time frame. HSDPA would not make a lot of sense at that point because right now there aren't any implementations on the infrastructure side for HSDPA with client with multiple antennas.
Let's say you're a small or large American city who wants to create a wireless cloud over your city.
Well, and that was my third example I was going to give.
Okay.
And we really haven't talked about Wi-Fi, but
right,
you know, take a look at Earthlink, for example.
Right.
And they were just talking about this publicly at WCA, so it's not last week, so it's not anything private that we know.
Right.
They have this huge issue called, I've got 5 million subscribers, about half of whom now have gone to broadband, and as soon as they go to broadband, if they don't leave me completely, they make me a money-losing proposition because
right,
I have to wholesale my broadband access to the DSL or cable providers.
Right.
So I, as Earthlink, would love to have a third pipe to the home.
Right.
And that actually is resonating with some of these municipalities that would like to solve their digital divide problems and so forth.
Well, in fact, that's what Philadelphia and Anaheim are doing. They've hired Earthlink to build
exactly,
these networks.
And the thing is, neither of those parties own licensed spectrum today.
Right.
And we've gone, because of our work in the IBURST environment over the last couple of years, we've gone all over the landscape of spectrum in the U.S., and it's an unfortunate reality that if you want to, as a new entrant in the space in the United States, you either have to have extremely deep pockets or a lot of patience because the spectrum is either expensive or highly fragmented or not available at all. In the right sweet spot, you know, between 500 or 600 megahertz to about 2.5 to 3 gigahertz.
Are you saying this makes it's going to make it difficult for Earthlink and or municipalities to roll something out?
Well,
the best
it makes it difficult for them. It makes it virtually impossible for them to do anything in licensed spectrum. However, there are 2.4 plus 5.8 gigahertz mesh network concepts where you put the, as Earthlink is proposing to do with Tropos and Motorola,
right,
they're using the Tropos equipment to build a roughly 3-story high cloud of Wi-Fi access using light poles
right,
all over a city, and then they use the the Motorola Canopy system at 5.8 gigahertz to backhaul that mesh network back to points of presence.
Okay, and now how does that fit in with the Raycom if it does in advanced antenna systems? Would that allow them to upgrade the Tropos and Motorola components of that system to a higher level? Without talking about proprietary negotiations
going on amongst the three of you. Yeah, we have to be a little careful because we're earlier stage here in some of these things.
But
it is certainly possible to address some of the operational issues that show up more so in the Tropos layer of that architecture than the Canopy layer, although Canopy layer would apply as well.
Right.
But the issues of in-building coverage and self-interference and all those other things, self-interference and co-channel interference are often synonyms.
Right.
Those issues are certainly there for what we call the municipal Wi-Fi space, the access point that's used for this kind of commercial service in a wide area deployment.
So speaking technologically and theoretically, there could be significant advantages to that kind of mesh linked to canopy system using advanced antenna systems.
It's certainly true.
Okay.
And again, in the landscape of technologies, the kinds of people who are going to gravitate to these mesh unlicensed band approaches are those who don't have licensed spectrum.
Right. Now,
the challenge you have is, you know, it's you're talking about tens of access points per square mile.
Right.
And so the maintenance load on an organization for this is an unproven.
Right.
That's a question, and the whole model is really unproven operationally.
Okay. Now,
Epicom, the guys who did Ricochet.
Right. Can attest to that, right.
Yeah, there may be some issues there.
But. Right. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, if you'll pardon the expression, from municipalities who would be starting from scratch and building these, what's the picture for Verizon and Singular and a huge telco carriers who might want to use advanced antenna systems to upgrade their capability, and what are the comparable time frames that they might have available to them compared to what the municipalities might be working with?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that the Verizon and Singular, or Verizon Sprint, well, and Singular as well,
right.
Mobile broadband-ish offers, and I use ish because they're, you know, they're not talking about. And when we talk about mobile broadband, one of the things we like to incorporate in that definition in the conversation is the substitution of this ubiquitous broadband access for the wired access that you had at home.
Right.
And that's definitely not what Verizon and Sprint are trying to do with their EVDO networks.
Well, what are they trying to do?
They're trying to deliver more or less to the road warriors and the early adopters.
Right.
Kind of neat multimedia services and television to your handset, that sort of thing.
Okay.
It's not meant as a complement to, but not a substitute for your primary desktop kind of access.
Okay. One step back. What we're calling broadband, a lot of people don't outside the United States. That's they don't call it dial up, but they don't call it broadband either. Could you fill in some specifics here about the speeds that we're talking about at these different advanced levels that might be possible here, and whether that would lead to what I guess people would want to call true broadband or broadband?
Broadband in on a global scale has become a very fuzzy term.
Right.
Initially, you're right, it meant no longer dial-up.
Right.
So it's roughly one, if not one and a half order of magnitude faster than the 50 kilobits per second you ever got with dial-up.
Right.
But, you know, clearly in Korea and Japan and a few other markets, broadband is now, you know, another order of magnitude beyond that.
And is that mainly delivered by fiber optic or by wireless in those
markets?
Well,
actually, they're using DSL.
Oh, okay.
They're advanced forms of DSL.
Oh, okay.
That work because of the geography of those markets.
The geography being?
Look at Seoul, Korea. It has a population density north of 10,000 people per square kilometer.
Right.
The best we ever, you know, the closest we can come is New York City, which is about 5.
Right.
So the average population density in the United States of any of the top 300 cities is on the order of 1,000 people per square kilometer, which is, you know, one-tenth of what you see in Seoul.
And having people concentrated together is very...
It makes DSL work better because the whole issue with DSL, if you, you know, went to get it yourself, you remember how far were you from the from the switch,
right.
The question. And the longer the wire, the lower data rate you get. It's very much like wireless. You know, the further away you are from the base station, the less data rate you get.
And by having a lot of people near the base station, you can get a lot of, there's a lot of people closer.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's why DSL is so fast in Japan and Korea.
Given the technologies we're talking about here for wireless, are comparable speeds possible technically?
Well, again, it all depends on how you architect the network. But people
right.
and when you throw smart antennas on both ends of the link,
right.
That helps a great deal. Typically, it doubles, especially when you put it on the subscriber device as well. You roughly double the data rate you can practically achieve otherwise. So,
what kind of data are
talking about for WiMAX networks is speeds in the neighborhood of 2 to 4 megabits per second per user, practically.
Is that both ways?
Yes.
Okay, and that's good. Is that good
well,
enough? Maybe not so much uplink.
You know, the thing is, downlink, you need to build your radio network so that the uplink and the downlink are matched.
Right.
And data rate you can achieve is directly correlated to signal strength.
Right.
And on the downlink, you've got this big, fat base station with
right.
its AC power driving
right.
you. And on the uplink, especially for mobile WiMAX or mobile anything,
right.
You've got a battery-powered device.
Right.
So
okay.
your power is necessarily more limited.
Right.
So to the extent that you can keep the data streams asymmetric,
right.
you're going to be able to balance your links better
okay.
and get more range.
So you're saying, though, 2 to 4 megabits downstream. And,
right. And typically a third of that upstream.
Okay. And is that enough for high-definition video?
Well, it depends on your codec and everything.
Right.
If
you get a good codec?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
I apologize, but I'm not familiar with kind of what people define as good.
Right, but
data rates
but definitely substantially viewable video.
Sure, and it's not HD. I doubt, but
it's especially on a smaller screen. It's
there's a lot of industry discussion of this is sort of a caveat emptor.
Right.
There's a lot of industry discussion about quote triple play on
right.
wireless.
Triple play on wireless, right.
Yeah.
Tell other people who aren't early adopters what the three parts of the triple play are.
Voice,
right.
Video,
right.
and data.
Okay.
So you get your internet access, your local phone service, and your cable subscription all on one pipe.
And of course, if you're hooked up to the network, it's your local access, you can talk anywhere.
Think about it as the phone in your house.
Right.
Right. Now, the problem with that over wireless is that, this is a little bit of math.
Right.
If you look at what your typical cellular phone bill is about, it translates, when you think it through, into roughly $1.25, typically,
right.
Per megabyte of capacity that you consume in a given month.
Okay.
Now, if you take your typical DSL bill or cable subscription for fixed broadband, that translates into something on the order of about 10 cents
right.
per megabyte that you consume.
Right.
So what I've just talked about is an order of magnitude, often 20-to-1 difference
right.
between what you as a subscriber are willing to pay for voice service versus what you're willing to pay for data service. So now we've talked about two parts of the triple play.
Right.
If you do the same kind of math on video,
right.
how many hours of television you watch in a given month versus how much you pay for your cable subscription and so forth, it's an order of magnitude yet again less. So I don't even pay you a penny per megabyte delivered if I'm the subscriber and you're my cable company.
Right.
Now, so the trouble is, with a cellular wireless network using 2G or 3G technology, which are, you know, in the same ballpark as far as this is concerned,
right.
I as an operator can make money delivering services for which people are willing to pay $1 a megabyte.
You're saying people will get paid, carriers will be paid 10 times as much for delivering a voice service and 100 times as much for delivering video service to mobile handsets. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. Think about this in terms of, I think you got these upside down.
Okay.
In terms of subscriber behavior.
Right.
If you offer me voice connectivity, I'm used to opening my wallet about $1 per megabyte.
Right.
If you talk to me about my internet access, I open my wallet 1/10 as far.
Right.
And then if you talk to me about video, I open it 1/100 as far.
Okay.
So what we've seen by taking, and I think by analogy you can extrapolate this to video, what we've seen by taking the internet and putting it in your mobile device, and
right.
this is true in South Africa and Australia and some other markets that have been early adopters of these mobile broadband technologies, is people will open their wallet a tiny bit further for ubiquitous mobile broadband, but not 10 times as far.
And what are the implications of that for whether these systems will be rolled out or not?
Well, so this gets back to, you know, ultimately investor dollars, whether they're from Wall Street or private investors,
right?
Private equity or VC or what have you, they only flow to these operators to the extent they have a business plan that makes any sense.
Okay.
So if the marginal cost of rolling out one of these networks is relatively low, which was the case for Verizon and EVDO, they can use it as a strategic weapon and kind of claim some strategic
bragging rights.
Advantage to it. And bragging rights, exactly, keeping up with the Joneses and so forth.
Right.
But to roll out, for instance, Sprint in their 2.5 spectrum, to roll out a big, fat, huge new network with a brand new technology, they better be able to say that this thing is going to have some cash flow that's positive, you know, sometime in the forecastable future.
Right.
Now, if you're going to roll a lot of video service onto that,
right,
and so if you take the argument that for ubiquitous data, ubiquitous mobile data access, I'll pay you, let's be generous and say 10% more.
Okay.
So that means that instead of a 10-to-1 difference between voice and data, there's only a 9-to-1 difference.
Right.
And between voice and video, instead of a 100-to-1 difference, it's 90-to-1. Right.
Right.
That's still, you've got to have a network that is 90 times more efficient per dollar spent on it than what is the case for cellular.
Now, can even advanced antenna systems deliver a 90 times more
effective? Well, we can help a lot.
Right.
But one of the key things, and this is why you see media flow and DVB-H and DMB in Korea showing up, people are kind of getting that you don't necessarily want to use your expensive two-way radio network to do broadcast.
Right.
So a broadcast network and a two-way network are two different things.
There was an announcement 2 or 3 days ago about a new an alliance being set up to do just that, to compete with MediaFlow, right?
Well, it's the work of Crown Castle in the U.S.
That's right.
With a handful of other folks, and they've actually been working on that for a couple of years now.
And what does that do, and how does it how does that fit into what we've been talking about? Castle's doing?
So we're actually seeing some real interest in the application of smart antennas to the DMB standard in Korea, which is
right. The
same. DMB, DVB-H, and MediaFlow are all essentially the same concept, which is broadcast television to handsets.
Okay, and how does that differ from the how does the economics of that differ from what we've just been talking about?
Key thing is it's broadcast.
Okay.
So you get much greater range out of your base stations, and you don't have to wait for the cell phone to. You don't have to limit your network to the uplink. Remember, I was talking about the balance between uplink and downlink.
Right.
So if you don't have to listen on the uplink,
right,
you can use the power of the base station to extend your range significantly, and therefore rolling out coverage in a wide area.
Does this mean that the end users and the handsets will essentially tune in to the broadcast rather than establish an internet connection to get it?
Well, what they would do is, and I think the kind of dual mode handsets that people are talking about are certainly in this direction. You use the DMB, DVB-H, or MediaFlow standard for your. It really is like tuning in a television.
Right.
It's a listen only transaction.
Right.
And then you use your two-way cellular or WiMAX or whatever technology for whatever interactivity you need to go along with it.
So the content distributors will essentially then be broadcasting multiple channels.
Mm-hmm. Just like plain old television.
That people tune in, except it'll be going through a different frequency range and it'll come onto the handsets.
Right. And it does have to be tuned a bit to the handset application because obviously the form factor is very different. So the navigation you need and the kind of content you want. You don't want to sit and watch the whole baseball game. You want the Yahoo 25-minute highlights thing that condenses the 2 hours into 25 minutes.
Okay. And so then the end users, if they want to exercise any interactivity or vote or pick the person to be dunked in the tank or something, they would use a different channel to do that.
You use a different channel to do that.
Okay.
And so then the whole thing hangs together. But you just have to be careful about people saying, well, I'm going to deploy a WiMAX network and do... I'm going to compete with the cable company by doing, quote, triple play all on my WiMAX network all by itself.
Okay. I think that...
Even with smart antennas.
Okay.
Like the good we can do.
All right. Talk then a little bit more about what's involved in getting more people to move ahead faster with the you've said the standards are pretty much in place, and it's the implementation now that's going on. So essentially, right. market forces are at work here, and people are competing to get to market sooner with all of this.
Yes, and it's actually it couldn't be a better time to work at Araycom because we now have three standards lining up more or less in sequence. That have settled on smart antennas as one of the key tools that they're using to meet operator objectives.
Right.
And all the manufacturers are scrambling to say, okay, how do we figure out how to do this?
Okay.
And our story about, hey, look, we're the guys that have been doing this longer than anybody in the industry in the commercial world. We know how to make it work in the real world, and there is still technical risk associated with making these boxes full of electronics really do what you want them to do in the radio environment.
Right.
We can make that easy and simple and very low risk for you.
And in fact, the three waves you were talking about for the three modalities, you'll essentially be able to deal with each of them in turn, and then use the experience that you generate in each level for the next one, and continue to perfect your techniques.
Well, I wish it were quite all that simple, but that's in principle, that's more or less how it works.
Okay, now specifically, last week, Araycom signed an agreement with PicoChip to integrate your two technologies. Tell us a little bit about that, if you can.
Sure. So part of the process as a manufacturer of client devices or base stations for WiMAX is deciding on your architecture for the layers directly up above the wires that connect to the antenna. So you have to do a whole bunch of processing at what's called the PHY layer, and then you have the media access control layer that does the scheduling of all the resources in the air link and interacts with the layers above that do all the ones and zeros. And so PicoChip, and we have partnerships with others in their category. If you look deeper on our press release list, you'll see something about our relationship with Intel.
Right.
PicoChip is an example of a company that is packaging both their processing hardware and software modules to make it very easy for base station manufacturers, say, you know, one of the telecommunications giants in Japan, for example, to move quickly down their development path to get gear in place for their customers who are looking for WiMAX equipment.
Right, so it's like a reference diagram?
It's kind of a reference design
built
on their chip. But it's a little more than a reference design. It's also software modules that implement these PHY and MAC layers that are key.
Right.
And what we've done with PicoChip is establish an agreement wherein their reference design and MAC and PHY layers are tuned to use our smart antenna approach, which fits in the middle of the PHY and interacts with the MAC.
Right.
And our stuff is being ported from the existing DSP platforms that they're being used for, with a couple of implementations now, we're porting to the PicoChip platform.
Okay, and is that a process well underway? And
yes.
Is there a timetable for it?
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, how everybody's kind of building the airplane while it's going down the runway here in terms of WiMAX. So,
what's very interesting about this, I'm looking at the questions that I prepared for a week ago for our discussion, and they talk all these questions about DSP are in a sense answered by this agreement that you've made with PicoChip, because it essentially leverages their advanced methods of computation with your design for the antennas.
Right. So there are advantages to... especially in an environment such as WiMAX, where we are building the plane while it's going down the runway, we're not even really sure what the flight plan is in terms of some of the technology choices inside this standard as it shakes out. A software-oriented platform, which is what PicoChip is about, is a great tool to build into your development roadmap. So we're pleased with that relationship. We, of course, there are others of our customers that make different architecture choices in terms of using the mix of ASICs and FPGAs and, if you will, kind of conventional DSPs. And we support those too. We're not religious about one of those architectures versus another.
So essentially, all of these then will make the other the parts that that connect to the antennas work better with them and be more efficient and make it easier for the people who build these base stations to do that.
Right, and the whole point of our efforts with these partners on the chip layer, if you will, is to make it easy to adopt our technology into the development roadmap for either the client side or the base station side.
Okay. Are you also working with people like Nokia and handset manufacturers to do what you're doing for the base stations for them?
Well, I can't name any names.
Right.
We do have an agreement with... I can't name any names on the manufacturer side in that area,
right.
But we do have an agreement with Telesis, which is another smaller company that's doing WiMAX client device silicon,
right?
To incorporate our software on their side,
and the signals that they'll be that Pico chips will be processing will then be reprocessed by these Telesis type chips.
So there is definitely a potential scenario in the world out there where you've got a Raycom on both ends of the link,
right.
Doing the antenna processing, but
right.
You've got a Telesis chip in your client device,
right.
And a Pico chip on the base station side. You could also have Pico chip on both ends,
right.
Working that scenario. You've got Intel on the client device side.
Right.
These WiMAX networks are going to see lots of different company names deep inside the architectures on both sides. But the relationships we're building are just making it possible for operators to use a Raycom's advanced processing on both ends, regardless of which manufacturer they're working with.
You're agnostic, and you can work with all of them, and they can all work with you.
Exactly.
Okay. Why don't we wrap up by just getting your sort of best case scenario for all this, and where you expect after 3 or 5 years of deploying all this, what we might be able to expect as end users taking advantage of advanced antenna systems.
Well, in 3 to 5 years, it should be the case, in the best of all possible worlds, that users will never even know,
right.
First of all, that this smart antenna thing is happening,
right.
Explicitly. But what they'll experience is the speed of their wired connection with the freedom of their cellular connection.
Right.
And many different client device form factors that take advantage of this. And the thing that actually makes us the most excited about this, and we're seeing some of the early signs of this in South Africa and in Australia,
right.
Is it's kind of a classic disruptive technology story in that when you provide a brand new capability to a community, what they're going to do with it is very difficult to tell ahead of time.
Right.
And so we've had notions of some of them we've been kind of right about, which is, you know, right now if you think about digital photography, for example.
Right.
You've got this mode, and this is more true for professionals than it is for
amateurs.
Right. But you've got this mode where you take this very expensive digital device out into the world, and you take shots, and then you have these things on a card.
Right.
And they're fat. So the only way you can get them back into the network and back where they belong in the home office where they'll show up on the web or in print is by plugging it into a wired computer and sending it over a LAN that goes to a wide area network and so forth.
I got to tell you, that's how I do it. I've got my little Casio S500, and I go out into the world and I take video and I plug it back into its cradle and put it into the desktop,
right.
And send it out to the web.
So, we haven't seen the full integration yet because the camera manufacturers haven't quite caught up with this, and the networks are still pretty early stage, so, which wide area broadband standard would they adopt,
right.
Is hard to tell. WiMAX is a good candidate, so is so is HTTPA, or EVDO for that matter. But what we've seen in Australia is professional photographers traveling with their expensive camera gear and a laptop with iBurst in it.
Right.
And so, one of them was saying, I was out, taking shots of a yachting sailing race in Sydney Harbor.
Right.
And he was so excited because he could send the images back immediately.
Right.
So, is that the most exciting application on the planet? Probably not. But what you'll find is once, and we think about it in terms of the way people use the internet when it went from dial-up to broadband changes.
Right.
It changes substantially. It becomes more integral to your life in lots of small ways.
Well, this essentially then, are you saying that these photographers, that the cameras are connected to the laptop by Bluetooth or something, or that the whole thing can, or that the cameras can go right back into the to the WiMAX network?
Yeah, it's a simple. So today, what it means in practical terms is you take your compact flash or your SD card out, you stick it in your laptop, and you upload immediately.
Right.
So it takes the time dimension out. It's still kind of a plugging things together hassle.
We can't you can't do it live, because obviously you want to be able to do it live,
off of the
camera through the WiMAX into the network.
So what these pros are showing the camera manufacturers is, there's a market for cameras with wireless access.
Right.
And that'll happen eventually.
Because I'm looking at my camera here now, and I'd like to plug on the little wireless access, yes. So I can then broadcast live from wherever I am.
Right, and think about it like the pro version of, you know, people with camera phones take shots and they multimedia message them to each other.
Right.
Think about the pro version of that, where you've got a 20 megapixel camera.
Right.
That takes a big fat raw file and then upload that wirelessly to your publication.
Right. Well, I'm working on the on that part of it. You keep working on the antennas, and we'll have it pretty soon, I think.
Sure.
I want it, and then we'll be able to do these interviews remotely, wirelessly, with video, and mm-hmm. broadcast them live.
I won't have to do this sitting at my desk.
That's right. You can go out to Tahiti or wherever you want, and as long as you get the base stations nearby.
Exactly.
All right. I want to thank you very much for working with this relatively primitive technology we've got now, and
sure.
And I look forward to using what we've been talking about to talk about it and its follow-on technologies in the future.
All right.
Thanks very much for visiting today.
Take care.
Okay, bye.